and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. During the run-up to last fall's election, we continued to hear the refrain about bringing back manufacturing jobs to America. But manufacturing has changed a lot in the last 30 years, and perhaps no one knows that better than Jay Timmons, the president and CEO of the National Association of Manufacturers. He's in Hawaii this week, and he's been visiting some of our state's manufacturing brands. We met up late yesterday to talk about the changes in manufacturing, what he sees coming back, including in Hawaii, and what is likely gone forever.
So I actually think manufacturing overall is just different. Like all sectors of the economy, nothing is the same. You think back 25 years ago and you think about the portable phone that you may have had. I thought I was one of those cool guys carrying around that big bag on my shoulder, you know,
and the brick.
And the brick, exactly. And frankly, all it was a two-way, at times, communication device. It wasn't a camera. It wasn't your email delivery system. So things change, and how products are made has changed greatly. So today, we have robotics and automation and virtual reality. There are folks who think, well, gosh, that means that there's not going to be enough, or there's not going to be as many manufacturing jobs in the future. And actually, I don't think anything could be further from the truth, because you've got to have someone who designs those systems. You have to have somebody that builds them, somebody that operates them, somebody that maintains them. So it is very different than the labor-intensive type of manufacturing that my grandfather was involved in back in the 1930s all the way to the 1970s. Today, manufacturing is clean, it's sleek, it's technology-driven, it's cool, and I frankly think it's kind of sexy. Manufacturing really just boggles the mind at what possibilities there are. So our goal is at the National Association of Manufacturers is to help workers, whether they're today's workers or tomorrow's workers, upskill their capabilities to be able to be a part of those upscale jobs of the future.
With a very different idea of what manufacturing is now, with 3D printing and so many other things that are continually to come.
Evolving,
exactly. What do you think are some very good indicators about where manufacturing is going?
So I think that wherever it goes, we're going to need a very strong STEM education program in our primary and secondary schools. STEM meaning science, technology, engineering, and math, and I would add mechanics into that. I've been fortunate enough to see around the country various high schools that are bringing back, you know, in my day we called it vocational education, and today it's really is kind of a skills training center for young people to be exposed to the modern manufacturing systems. And so you talked about 3D printing. I've been in high schools where they're doing 3D printing, where they are where they have CAD design capabilities. So young people are starting to learn these skills, starting to be intrigued by these skills. But in all honesty, we have a perception problem in manufacturing. I said before that manufacturing today is clean, it's sleek, it's technology-driven. There's still this aura or this belief that it's somehow dirty, dark, and dangerous.
Well, you called it sexy, too.
Yeah, I think it is. You know, and I think when kids see it, they get so excited about it. I mean, you know, what young person doesn't like to build something, create something of their own? I got to speak at the University of Kansas a couple years ago, and I asked the question, who here is thinking about a career in manufacturing? 1,000 kids. Zero hands went up. And then I said, hey, pull out your cell phone or iPhone or whatever you have. Now, tell me, who in this audience wants to make the next great thing that will transform the world? 2/3 of the hands went up in that audience. So it's redefining what manufacturing is and what that perception of manufacturing is.
Do you think that idea is well understood by the American public, especially after we've come through a campaign that clearly was looking back over its shoulder and hoping for those good old days?
Well, let me start with the positive. The positive is, regardless of your feelings about the outcome of the election. It is very clear that this president and this Congress are laser focused on building the manufacturing economy and strengthening manufacturing in this country. And they've outlined an agenda for competitive tax policy, for regulatory reform, for infrastructure investment that will help us achieve that. But the thing that does disappoint me is your point. You know, looking back to the past, hearkening back to, well, you know, let's bring back the good old days. And I don't think there's any part of life where you can do that. We all look fondly upon things in our past. You know, I think about my days on the farm when I was a teenager.
But you can't go home again.
But I can't go home again. And you know, when I think about it, I don't think I really want to be mucking out those stalls every day. You know, that's really not what I was. I don't think I was particularly good at. And I'd rather not do that. So I'm all about looking to the future, and I'm looking about building kind of that new economy that is very much knowledge based, but requires a certain type of skills that that I think we're going to be able to achieve in this country with the right amount of focus.
So now let's focus on Hawaii. Once upon a time, there was a very vibrant manufacturing culture for textiles. And things have clearly changed since the 60s and 70s and even into the 80s. And now there is this feeling that we can resurge manufacturing. What do you see when you look at us after seeing all of the places that you've been to and all of the startups that you've seen?
So I think, obviously, it's very different in Hawaii. You do have logistical concerns. You have shipping costs that have to be a factor. But, for instance, I went to Coastal Windows, and I saw a product started 27 years ago with three different products. Today there's 15. And I asked the question, I said, is your market only Hawaii? And he said, well, it's certainly our largest market, but we also manufacture and we export to islands and government and countries in the Caribbean, because there's similar weather patterns there. And these windows are, you know, very very well built for the Hawaiian environment. And I think that's a good example of where progress can be made for various products. I talked to the folks at Latour Bakery, and by the way, it's just fantastic. The bread that I got to sample there, and I said, you know, if you ever think about expanding, I can tell you the East Coast of the United States, they're snobs about their bread, and there would be no question, it would be in high demand. So I think just kind of looking out at the possibilities, understanding that there may be a cost premium for the shipping, but understanding that the quality of the products that are made here will be appealing to other markets.
As you look at us, you must clearly see things that we are not seeing, even though we have a manufacturing initiative. It's a conversation that we've been having for years and years, how to resurge, how to restart, how to reinvent it. What do you see?
Well, yeah. So I think it's the same advice that I would give any state, and I would give it certainly to the federal government, and it's something that I think the federal government is working on. You've got to reduce the cost of doing business. Those things that you can control, try to reduce those costs so that you can invest in plants, equipment, labor, job creation. We can compete against anybody in the world. And I say we, I'm talking about the United States as a whole now. We can compete against any country in the world if we reduce those costs. So it's about 12% to 24% more expensive to manufacture in the United States because of the highest tax rate in the world, because our 297,696 regulations that directly apply to manufacturers cost $35,000 per employee per year in regulatory compliance costs. That's just the federal burden. If you reduce those barriers, you unleash the ability of businesses to invest and create jobs here in the United States, in Hawaii, in any other state in our country.
Before I let you go, I've got to ask you about the minimum wage, because we've been watching the fight for 15 happen now for a few years. Clearly in Hawaii, as it is so expensive for people to live here, to find affordable housing, to just maintain what in other states wouldn't be an issue. Is that also part of the way that you look at Hawaii a little differently? And what would you tell the business community here? Because they may say, well, if I'm trying to control costs, well, labor is a big part of that. How do I slice that down when a lot of the people they may need, in fact, need to have a living wage?
So I can really only speak for manufacturers because that's the sector of the economy that I represent. Manufacturers pay for skilled labor. So the minimum wage really is not that big of a factor for us because we end up paying far more than the minimum wage in general terms. That said, you know, if I'm looking at it from a macroeconomic perspective, I think policymakers have to be very careful about prescribing a certain pay scale because ultimately what you end up doing is you start to force businesses to make horribly difficult choices. And if they are not profitable and they are suddenly forced to pay a much higher wage, they're going to start reducing the number of people that are working. And you've now created a counter cycle to what you're trying to achieve. So you want to hire as many people as you can to do as good of a job and to service your customers and your clientele. And then suddenly you're being forced to look at reducing labor costs. And I don't think that's what policymakers want to achieve. But again, for manufacturers, it's really not that much of an issue for us because, by and large, we pay well, we pay premium.
Another good reason to hope that manufacturing resurges. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jay Timmons is president and CEO of the National Association of Manufacturers. It's the largest manufacturing association in the United States, representing 12 million workers in the manufacturing sector.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the story of a little girl in an oversized world comes to Honolulu Theater for Youth. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we remember one of the first Native Hawaiians to record in print the history of his people. He was born in 1793 in Keauhou on Hawaii Island and grew up in the reign of Kamehameha I during the years when the warrior king was uniting the islands into a single kingdom. In 1823, he moved to Lahaina and became a student of a missionary, Reverend William Richards, who taught him to read and write in both English and Hawaiian and converted him to Christianity, baptizing him and giving him a Christian name. He graduated from Lahaina Luna School as part of its very first class and later became schoolmaster at his alma mater. His grave is located above the school, and its boys' dormitory is named after him. The school holds an annual celebration in his honor in mid-April, and today we're looking for his name. If you know it, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and if you're first and right, you get the prize.
Aloha, I'm Sonia Patel from Honolulu, Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
The The story of Thumbelina, the very little girl born from a flower, has the kind of classic fairy tale elements that lend themselves to the kind of adaptation that has become a specialty of Honolulu Theater for Youth, which has made her story into a real-time storybook that unfolds before your eyes. Eric Johnson is HTY's artistic director, and he's with us in our studio. Hello, Eric. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here, Chris.
When we say that she's a little girl, we mean that she's a little girl. I mean, like, little, right?
That's right. One of the big questions that any theater maker tackling the story has to take on is how do you deal with a character who's the size that can fit in her mom's hand?
Yeah.
And so we had a great team of designers that took on that challenge. Y. York was the playwright. We were the first people to do this particular adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
So we started fresh with some new ideas. And what we came up with was a solution that is both old and new technologies. We have a mini toy theater, which you can imagine this tiny little theater that
like
sits
a dollhouse
dollhouse, exactly. And it sits in front of the actual stage. And then we have a video camera that is taking pictures of the toy theater and then projecting them onto a huge screen. So what we can have is a tiny little flower that, or a flower cutout or silhouette that we bring onto the toy theater.
Uh-huh.
And then Thumbelina, who's an actual actress, a live person, is tiny and dwarfed by this large flower from the toy theater. So we're playing with scale in some really fun and exciting new ways. So you're getting real actors on stage, a real person who is Thumbelina, mm-hmm. but she is actually tiny.
And the actors who are portraying the other characters are projected as larger than she is?
Some of them are. You know, there are all kinds of different techniques that we're using in this piece. Some of them are huge puppets, mm-hmm. like the toad is this tremendous toad mouth, and, you know, that would be that size of a toad. And then some of them are actually, they show up as shadows in the toy theater, and some of them are projected and part puppet, part projection. We're also using green screen techniques, which is what they use on big action movies,
right.
where you'll see an actor on one side of the stage against green, and then they're projected onto the other side of the stage where they can be any size we want them to be. Mm-hmm. So in that way, we can take out the backgrounds, and you're seeing both all things at once. So I think that's where the theater becomes exciting, because you're actually seeing these actors that are playing with puppets, much like a kid might play with a doll.
Uh-huh.
And then you're also seeing actors on stage, you know, being green screened like you would a behind the scenes, you know, clip from a movie. And then all that feeds into this very beautiful Victorian storybook of an image that we're creating in the actual, you know, sort of on stage action.
It really does sound like a fusion of old and new technology, right? Huge puppets with green screen techniques. It also sounds like a lot of work, Harry.
Well, it was a lot of work, but it's a lot of fun work.
Yeah.
You know, and what we're finding, we've had a couple of audiences so far, and we're finding that, you know, the young people are just. This is their language. They understand lots of visual imagery from different scales and different sizes. So they have no trouble, and they're really taken, and they just follow the story. And then the grown-ups are like, whoa, how did you do that effect?
Yeah.
You know, I want to see more of that. I think it truly is something that a whole family could enjoy the experience together.
Because it also sounds as if you're not afraid to show how the magic is created.
Right.
You're seeing the magic, and you're seeing the means by which it's given to you.
And I think that is one of the things that is different with live theater and with cinema, mm-hmm. that we're using very, very cinematic techniques. And in fact, the same techniques that many people have used in film adaptations of Thumbelina. Mm-hmm. But the difference with live theater is I can choose to look over here at this. I can choose to look at the scenery and the actors creating that. That as an audience member, I'm in the room with the performers, and everything is right there in front of my eyes. eyes.
It also, you know, the message, I think, for theater is don't be afraid to show how it's done.
Right.
That can
right.
actually enhance the experience, you know. And cinema is so preoccupied with not showing.
Yes.
How it's done, you know, hiding that very thing. You're supposed to believe it. And you know, as cinema gets more outlandish with CGI, it becomes impossible to believe that, you know, that it isn't the result of artifice.
And I think that is something that is just so beautiful for young people
yeah.
to see, because you're creating literacy on multiple fronts. One is the content. I mean, this is a great story of all time, you know, one of the classics that has mm-hmm. Remained. So you're diving into a lovely classic story. But then you're also looking at some beautiful theatrical techniques, and you're looking at illustration and visual art mm-hmm. That you would see in a book, but in a way that you're actually seeing it made before your eyes. So we're hoping that what that does is sparks the imagination of young people to go out and, you know, what are the tools when I'm going to tell stories of my own, and which stories do I want to tell? And I think that's our highest mission there at HTY.
One of the things that I've always envied about your job, Eric, is that the mandate is that you have to be able to think like a child, and hence keep alive your sense of wonder. You don't have a choice, right?
Yeah. Well, I think that the audience that comes in demands that. And when you see the shining faces and the creative creativity they bring as audience members, that is there. One thing I will also add is the score for this piece is a 100% original, and the sound designer has done kind of a score where every animal has like a different instrument associated with them. From, you know, the toad has a tuba, and the butterfly is a harp, and so there's kind of this Peter and the Wolf kind of soundtrack to the piece, which I think is truly in an hour you're getting to appreciate many, many different kinds of art forms, visual arts, music, theater, film, are all coming together in telling the story.
And in the story, the little girl Thumbelina herself kind of discovers herself.
Right. And I think that's what drove us into some of these choices is mm-hmm. that you have a young person who is born from a flower and is filled with curiosity and wonder and wants nothing more than to explore the world. And so she, of course, gets herself into trouble. She ends up underwater. She ends up flying through the air, taken on a flight by a beetle. And she lands into this marvelous garden of possibilities on the search back to find her mother. And so it's a heartwarming story. It's a story for the full family, and it has enough adventure for boys as well, which I keep telling people, because the Thumbelina, it's delightful for girls to see a girl in a flower dress, but there's plenty of adventure for everybody.
Half of kids are boys, after all. Thanks so much, Eric.
Thank you.
Eric Johnson is the artistic director of Honolulu Theater for Youth, whose current production of Thumbelina runs weekends until May 29th at Tenney Theater in downtown Honolulu.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
The days of this year's legislative session are running short. With tomorrow's second crossover deadline, Hawaii lawmakers are in a frenzy to continue to move the bills they support. And in the State House, yesterday's clash over a bill to scale back judges' pensions. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the reality check. Hey, Chad.
Hey, Beth Ann.
So why did this bill cause such a bipartisan kerfuffle?
Well, it's a strange bill. Just briefly, what it would do is scale back from 3% to 2% the pension rate for state judges. This is the second time in 5 or 6 years they've seen that pension rate go down. And they are the only branch of government, the only position being singled out for this cut. And what's got a lot of people talking at the Capitol, and as you said, Republicans and Democrats, is why are we only singling these people out? Andrea Tupola, she's the minority leader, she said she tried to kill the bill. She said, look, not a single person, not a single organization testified in support. And she's right. I looked through the committee reports. A whole lot of other people, including the judiciary and a number of other organizations, a lot of unions, said, why are you doing this? This is essentially attacking, having the legislative branch attack the executive. So it's a real head scratcher. And one wonders as we go into conference committee, because the bill did pass, whether this is going to be something that's going to survive the end of this month and the end of the session.
Oh, to have been a fly on the wall when that recess happened yesterday. So right now we know, as you say, it has passed and we don't really know how it's going to move forward.
Right.
But in general, when you have just this kind of, you know, fervor over a bill and you have the kind of dissension that we've seen over it at this late in the session, I mean, are we simply going to see more and more of this? Is just the tip of the iceberg?
Certainly, it smells a little bit of politics, and I wasn't a fly on the wall, but I was definitely present in the chamber gallery yesterday, and you saw the lawmakers, both sides, huddling and trying to, you know, smooth things over. But Cynthia Thielen, another Republican, said, look, this is just a classic example of bad policy. And Gene Ward, another Republican, even said he called for a roll vote, and he was shot down on that idea. He kind of hinted at censorship. Whoa, that started a whole nother recess. You know, it wasn't all that long ago that they did kill a bill to have greater pesticide use disclosure. Remember Angus McKelvey essentially losing his chair position? But that bill actually did have some support as well as opposition, unlike this one. And again, I stress, not a single, I couldn't find it anyway, not a single indication of support for this idea to cut back the pensions of our judges. A lot of support saying they do hard work. They've earned the money. Let's help them out.
Meanwhile, we've got a lot of other issues that are going to cause a lot of drama between now and May 4th, which we will be talking about.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Chad.
Thanks, Bethan.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat, and we feature a reality check from Civil Beat each day. Sexual assaults and unwelcome sexual advances on military campuses continue to make news, despite multiple programs to both prevent attacks and make it easier for victims to report them. Last month, the AP reported that the Naval Academy in Annapolis and the U.S. Military Academy in West Point logged year-over-year increases in assaults. Only the Air Force Academy in Colorado posted a decrease. Jill Loftus would like to see that replicated across all military campuses. She's the first director of the Department of the Navy's Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Office. She's in Hawaii with a new theater-based interactive training called Pure Praxis. We talked earlier, and I asked her about the impact of the AP story.
We really don't know that the incidence is really going up, the prevalence. We really know that reporting is throughout the military at large. Both the Marines and the Navy, we see reporting coming out, and we hope that that's because people feel much more comfortable coming forward. We think the incidence, the prevalence rate, is going down amongst all our sailors and Marines. We know that alcohol is a big factor, and we really have started to go after the alcohol piece in both the Navy and the Marine Corps, and at Annapolis on the campuses there. It's a lot less than it is on college campuses throughout the country, so we think we're making some strides there.
We've heard the idea that you've just talked about. People feel more comfortable to talk about it now. comfortable to talk about something that happened after the fact, but getting to the why it's happening seems to be the big issue. How do you think we approach that differently now through the program that you're bringing?
Well, we really, you know, one of the factors with the military and the population that we bring in, over 25% of our population has been victimized before they even come into the military. That's something that we have to deal with, something that's out in society. We really try now at boot camp and at the first time they go to their technical schools to have small group discussions, to talk about what's in the general public, to talk about that there are victims all amongst us. You know, 1 in 5, 1 in 4, there's a lot of different statistics out there. But we have a lot of small group discussions in small units, on ships, in our military populations, with leadership, to have the discussion, to really talk about what is sexual assault, what is the definition, what does it mean to be a victim of sexual assault, and how can we give support to those amongst us who are victims, and have that conversation and really discuss what it is to be an active bystander, to look for the signs that we may not have recognized in the past, how to be aware of situations that might cause those sexual assaults. And hopefully we're making people more cognizant of the surroundings and what's going on around them that they might not have seen in the past.
It sounds as if you're saying that in many ways a situation that's happening in society as a whole winds up on your doorstep.
It really does, and we need to be prepared for that. We don't know who victims are or survivors are. We don't ask when they come, so we have to be certainly aware of it. And one of the things we're doing is a lot of training, interactive training on recognizing situations that are retaliatory or maybe ostracizing others who may report sexual assaults. And we try to make people who are in small situations like that recognize that there may be other survivors amongst them who are their friends and who are their colleagues that they don't know may be survivors and what kind of damage that might do to them. So as part of our theatrical group right now, we've got a group called Pure Praxis that's here doing performances. We talk about retaliation, social ostracism, you know, for those who report sexual assaults, and we let them know that maybe the person next to them that's standing by watching them may be affected by their behavior.
As you are now touring around with Pure Praxis, what specifics to this program are different from ones that may have happened even in just the past few years?
Well, this is very, very interactive, and it engages the audience and makes them participate. They're part of the show. This is a small group, 8 people who are, they're professional actors, they're young people, they're in their 20s and 30s. They relate to the young sailors and Marines in the audience. And when they do scenarios, they ask for the audience's suggestions on how they might have acted differently or how they may have intervened in situations. And then they call the audience up on stage. If you've given a suggestion, you get to act with them. And they don't just passively let you get away with just trying out your intervention. They act against you. And so they let you know how hard it is to try to intervene in a situation. And so each show is different. I've seen hundreds of these shows, and each one is different because each sailor and each Marine has a different idea of how to disrupt the behavior.
What behaviors have been incorporated into shows as you've moved forward?
Well, we started out with just an awareness of the situations. We started out with bystander intervention. That was the first iteration of this. And now we've gone into more of a how to recognize retaliation and social ostracism and male sexual assault. This also has elements of male sexual assault, and someone in the show is a victim of child sexual assault and never reported until this time when they're in the service. And so this is that nuanced idea that maybe your best friend or a colleague or a shipmate may have been the victim of child sexual assault.
So this seems to be a mix of improv, a focus group, a lot of interactivity. How will you measure success when Pure Praxis is done?
Well, we measure it in a couple of ways. We do a lot of focus groups everywhere we travel, and that's how this has evolved even this show, because I travel all over the world. I talk to sailors and Marines. We ask them after shows, what was good about this? What was bad? What did you think? What did we get right? What did we get wrong? And that's how we improve, we hope, our shows. And after this show is over, we'll do a lot of surveys on command culture, command climates. And we always ask the question, did you intervene in a situation that you thought might have resulted in either a sexual assault, or did you find yourself intervening in a situation that may have been retaliatory or social ostracism? And we're now up to the point where we're getting 80 to 90% of sailors say they would have or they did intervene, which is certainly a lot more than we saw 2 years ago.
Is there anything more that you think about this program that the rest of us don't really know or understand that we should?
Well, I think that a lot of the performances and the intervention work that we do is certainly transferable into the general public. A lot of this work could be done in elementary, even intermediate high schools, for bullying, for ostracism. We see a lot of that maybe people don't recognize those situations. A lot of times, I think that children even don't recognize when somebody is being bullied. I think that they don't get to act it out and practice. It's almost like athletes who practice, you know, before they play tennis, they hit many, many tennis balls. I remember when I played basketball, we did a lot of free throws before we played in a game. I think that if you get to practice your intervention skills, that you will find that you're much better at recognizing the situation and jumping in and acting.
Ms. Loftus, I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Jill Loftus is the first director of the Department of the Navy's Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Office. Her office is in Hawaii this week with Pure Praxis, a theater group that uses improvisation and audience participation to confront social issues, including sexual assault, bystander intervention, and harassment.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we thought about a native Hawaiian historian whose early efforts included translations from the Bible and notes on Hawaiian religion and cultural history. He grew up on Hawaii Island during the period when Kamehameha I was bringing the islands together into a single kingdom. In his early years, he was associated with the chief Kuakini, who was a brother of Queen Ka'ahumanu, serving as oral historian and court genealogist. After he moved to Maui and converted to Christianity, he began a close association with Lahaina Luna School. He was a member of its first graduating class, and today it honors its memory with an annual celebration. Its boys' dormitory is named after him. In 1841, he helped form the first Hawaiian Historical Society. Devotees of Hawaiian history still honor the memory of David Malo.
And this was a very, very popular quiz. We had people calling us from all over Hawaii who knew that answer, Chris. But the winner is Craig Seneff, who called us from Kihei and will be receiving the prize. If any of you have a quiz question for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, helping strengthen the school-home connection with Home Edition, an online tool with reading and writing tailored to each student's ability. Achieve3000.com.
Anna Danes is a jazz vocalist whose latest recording is called Find Your Wings, and its title could be used to describe the arc of her career. She's an attorney, former practicing attorney, whose family fled Poland when it was still under communist domination, and her career as a singer came to her relatively late in life. Her material combines great American songbook classics with her own originals, and she's with us in our studio. You know, for any artist, it's impossible to separate the life from the art, but it seems particularly apt in your case.
It's very true. And it's wonderful to be able to tell your life, your stories through music.
Yeah.
The language is universal, and people can, of course, relate to a lot of what I'm singing about.
Growing up in Poland, jazz has to have kind of represented freedom for you, in a sense.
Yes, freedom of expression, interpretation, and so on, and improvisation, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Jazz, like life, is about just rolling with it.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of been the theme of my life thus far.
And I'm assuming that in the Poland of your youth, jazz was not celebrated, right? It was
celebrated underground.
Underground,
yeah. Definitely. There were no such things as jazz clubs except here and there.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. It was probably too tempting for too many to define jazz because it means freedom.
And that was always objectionable,
yes,
to communist regimes.
Absolutely, yeah.
But you got out of there. I mean, your family defected.
We did. We left in 1979 before the borders were closed and martial law was declared. My dad had this inkling that it was all going to happen, and he just did not envision our family having a full life staying in Poland. So we got out on a travel visa, which was only supposed to take us out of the country for 2 weeks. We went to Sweden, and we never came back. And sadly, I never saw some of my friends or family ever again.
You know, Americans have grown up in such relative comfort and freedom that it's difficult for us to even imagine living in a country where you can't leave, you can't, listen to jazz music in public.
That's right. Yeah, all these freedoms that we take for granted, even freedom of thought. I was raised from a young age not to say what was truly on my mind, not to trust neighbors, even sometimes friends, because you don't know who is watching you, who is going to tell the police.
Mm-hmm.
And that's no way to live. You kind of live a double life. You put yourself in hiding.
I bet.
Inside.
So what led you to become a jazz performer?
This is not something I had ever planned. Music had followed me, of course, my entire life, jazz in particular, but also other genres like disco. Growing up in Poland in the 70s, mm-hmm. ABBA was huge. So I grew up listening to very happy music, but jazz came into my life again in my early 40s when my then 7-year-old didn't want to continue her singing lessons.
Mm-hmm.
She sat there stubbornly with her arms folded and said, "No more, I'm done." And I didn't want to waste the lesson being the practical mom. And the teacher said, "Would you like to try it?" And I did. And here we are. That was about 4 or 5 years ago now. And I've not looked back.
Well, that's quite a pretty rapid ascent to becoming a, recording artist, performing artist in just a few years.
Yes. Yeah, it's been such a joyous journey, though, and I've been just following my path as it reveals itself, and I've had a tremendous amount of luck. I've also worked very, very hard. I've had the freedom to do so. So I've made up for a lot of time very quickly.
This fits right into the sound of the title tune of your second CD. Let's hear just a fragment of that.
Love surrounds you everywhere. Angels see no darkness there. Find your wings. When the voice of doubt creeps in, slay the dragon in its den. Move that ego into place.
It's a very personal tune, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. I call it an ode to believing in yourself, stepping outside of self-doubt and soaring.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish I had known this years and years ago, but better late than never.
Well, yeah, and you have to be ready for any kind of new approach to life, don't you?
Yes, absolutely. There was no way that I could have done this 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
The opportunity was not there. It had not even crossed my mind. I was happy being a mom and taking care of my family.
this. And you were a lawyer.
And I was a lawyer and a business owner with my ex-husband. So, yeah, life was very different. Everything happens at the right time.
Well, you know, in order to express something, you have to have a self to begin with, right?
Yes. And I found that self through music. It ended up really liberating me and also giving me confidence like I've never had before. The fact that I could express myself freely, the fact that I was speaking about subjects that uplifted me, such as love, and you find love all over the American songbook, of course. And I just felt empowered by all of it and saw life very differently from that moment, knowing that I can continue to express myself and talk about the things I want to talk about without somebody like an oppressor, say, back in Poland, or unfortunately my ex-husband who was largely controlling. I just knew that these were my wings, my voice, and I kept going, and I left that marriage, formed a production company, recorded 2 albums. I sing now everywhere, and just did another show with the San Diego Symphony. I've sang the national anthem a number of times in front of thousands. It's quite a fascinating journey.
That takes a lot of confidence to be able to do that. And you know, a lot of people would find any of those experiences you just described pretty terrifying, getting in front of 1,000 people. And the national anthem is no picnic to sing either.
No, it's not. But that is the one thing that I probably love performing more than anything. Aside from my originals, having gone through immigration 3 times now, it means so much for me to have finally found home. Mm-hmm. And the meaning of the anthem, the lyrics, really speak to me. I get really choked up just talking about it.
Well, that's what informs the sound that you're making, right?
Right.
If you didn't, you know, it's almost a mystical thing. If you weren't feeling those emotions, you couldn't possibly express them.
True, absolutely true. And that goes for all the songs I sing. I pick them consciously to tell something that's indirectly going on inside of me or something that I can at least relate to because I've gone through it maybe in the past. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes real and authentic. And then just like Sinatra used to do, you can tell the emotion is real. It's genuine. He is one of my all-time heroes because of his storytelling ability. But it came from deep inside.
Well, at the end of the day, a song is a story, right?
Yes. Yes, but so much more, especially if you can tell it in a way that others will absorb it with their hearts as well.
Yeah. Great to talk to you, Anna. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anna Dane's latest recording is called Find Your Wings, and you can learn more about her and hear samples of her music on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
I want to be around to see how she does it when she breaks your heart to bits. Let's see how that puzzle fits. So fine. And that's when I'll discover that revenge is sweet as I sit there applauding from a front row seat.
Support for The Conversation comes from Matson, in appreciation of HPR's local public affairs programming. Since 1882, working to support Hawaii's economy and communities. Matson.com.
This is the opportunity that we have every day in our show to look at activities going on throughout the state with Morning Edition host and our colleague, Derek Malama, who joins us to look at events going on that are a little bit under the radar. And today we have one at the Hawaiian Historical Society.
Yes, they will be discussing Molokai's leprosy settlement. This is tomorrow. Mm-hmm. At 6 p.m., the Society will screen the documentary film Soul of Kalaupapa. At 7:30, Fred Woods will provide reflections of Kalaupapa by patients, employees, visitors, and his own observations based on oral history, interviews, and personal experience. Q&A session will end the evening. An RSVP is not required. And this is happening at Kapi'olani Community College in the cafeteria starting at 6 p.m. tomorrow.
The whole story of the Hansen's disease settlement there is really one of the great stories of Hawaii, isn't it?
Yeah, very dramatic.
And you can find out about guided meditation on Maui, which is a big subject on Maui.
Yes, it's meditation with the help of a guide. It's self-explanatory there. And one of the easiest ways to enter into a state of deep relaxation and inner stillness. We all need that every once in a while.
Yeah.
Swaj Kare will be your guide to help you find peace and inner bliss by letting go of emotional baggage. And this program is free and open to all adults. It's at 6:30 tomorrow night in the Wailuku Public Library.
I think there are many people out there who could benefit from that.
Oh, yes.
As they could benefit from learning more about handling their finances.
Yes, this is a free workshop at the Kailua Kona Library. It's a three-hour workshop where you can learn how to create a spending plan, start a savings plan, build credits, and apply for job and employment benefits. Participants who attend the entire session will be entered in a drawing for a gift certificate. A light refreshments will be provided, and this program is free to the public. It's from 1 to 4 p.m. tomorrow at the Kailua Kona Library.
That's one way to handle your finances, to win a free gift certificate.
Right. And this thing is free on top of that.
Yeah. Terrific, Derek. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. And you can always find out about more about those events and others on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
That's going to do it for us for the conversation for today. Coming up tomorrow on Town Square, we take up the long-standing battle among homeowners using their homes for shared short-term rentals, the companies who help them do it, and the neighborhood and hospitality associations that would like to stop them. And, of course, your calls are always welcome.
And we like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line, leave us your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation, or at BKOZHPR.
If you missed any part of the show or just want to hear something again, you can always do that by checking our conversation page. It's got links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. I'll see you tomorrow for Town Square.